Chapter 15. Sanctum, Catharsis, and Fishig. Tet Uinsar, Promedy. 15 days later, we were a long, long way from New Givet, a long way from Gudrun itself. I had, for the time being, evaded the clutches of Kanyar the Sharp. The morning before my meeting, or my puppet's meeting, I should say, with Marla Tare in the Midhive Bar, Amos and I had arranged passage on a packet lighter called the Spirit of Whiston, and by the evening we were leaving the planet. 5.5 days out from Gudrun, in the vicinity of Saito, we rendezvoused with the SN. My old friend Tobias Maxilla, eccentric master of the sprint trader SN, had come in response to the glossier code word Sanctum without hesitation, breaking off from his merchant runs in the Helicon Spinwards and laying course for Gudrun. He had never been a formal part of my operation, but he was an ally of long standing, and had provided the services of his ship on many occasions. He always claimed to do this for financial reward. I regularly made sure the Ordos remunerated him handsomely, and to keep on the good side of the Imperial Inquisition. Privately, I believe his allegiance to me was the product of an adventurous streak. Getting involved in my business offered more diverting occupation than a trade voyage down the Helicon Worlds. There was no ship, and no ship's master, that I trusted more than Tobias Maxilla and the SN. With my life shattered, my back to the wall, and an enemy after my blood, he was the one I turned to for rescue and escape. One could also always rely on Maxilla to lift a company's spirits. In truth, the mood in my little group had been uncomfortable since New Givet, and that was largely my own fault. As soon as I had realized that Nail was just another of Glor's deceits, a ruse to lure me into a trap, I had set my trap in return. Certain sections of the Malus Codicium concern the creation and remote animation of thralls, human beings psionically controlled as puppets. I had never tried the technique, for it seemed ghoulish. The Codicium suggested the process worked best with a freshly killed cadaver. But on the other hand, it was simply an elaborate extension of my use of will, and it suited my purpose. I didn't go into detail about what I was going to do, but Medea, Elena, Crezia, and Amos knew something unorthodox was afoot, and they were all concerned when I had Ettrick's body covertly taken from the train to a lodging we had rented in Hive 4. Crezia mumbled something about body-snatching, and Medea was dubious. Back aboard the Pulchritude, she shrugged off as a joke the idea that I was dabbling too far. She seemed to have accepted the whole business with Cherubale. Now she seemed less confident about esoteric psychotricks. Even Amos seemed reserved. He had not said a word about the Malus Codicium since he'd seen me remove it from the safe in my study, and he'd made it clear on several occasions that he trusted my judgment. But there had still been a feeling in the air. I kept them out of the room while I performed the rituals, and that may have been a mistake too. Except for Alina, who was spared the sensations, they all felt the unnerving, creeping backwash of the act. I had also never used a warp vortex before, but it seemed the only weapon I could equip my thrall with that would trap the trappers. In hindsight, I wonder if the Malus Codicium had planted the idea in my head. The vortex worked. It destroyed the enemies who had tried to snare me. I doubt I will use one again. The feedback left me unconscious, and I was ill and weak for 2 days afterwards. My friends had to break down the door of the room to get at me, and they must have been shaken by the sight that greeted them. The burnt circle on the floor, the psi-plasmic residue trickling off the walls, the symbols I had painted. I think they felt for the first time that I had attempted something I wasn't quite in control of. Perhaps they were right. None of them had wanted to talk about it. Amos had found the Malus Codicium on the floor beside me and slipped it into his pocket before the others could see it. Later, aboard the Spirit of Whiston, he'd handed it back to me privately.
"I don't want to touch it again," he said. "I don't think I want to see it again."
I was unhappy at his reaction. His life was devoted to the acquisition of knowledge. It was an actual clinical compulsion in his case. But there he was, rejecting a source of secret data, albeit dark, that could be found almost nowhere else in the galaxy. I thought he alone might appreciate its worth.
"It's the Malus Codicium, isn't it?"
"Yes."
"They never found it. On Farnus Beta, after Quixos fell, the Ordos searched for it and never found it."
"That's true."
"Because you took it for yourself and never told them."
"Yes. It was my decision."
"I see. And that's how you learned to control demon hosts too, isn't it?"
"Yes."
"I'm disappointed in you, Gregor."
Maxilla was, as ever, the perfect host, and the general spirit did pick up a little once we were in his company. He met us at the SN's four starboard air gate, dressed in a checkered sedral gown coat. A blue silk cravat, pinned with a golden star pin, and a purple suede calotte with a silver tassel. His skin dye was gloss white with black hearts over his eyes, and a fine platinum chain ran between the diamond earring in his left lobe to the sapphire stud in his nose. Behind him, gold-plated servitors waited with salvers of refreshments. He greeted us all, flirting with Medea and making a particular fuss of Crezia and Alina, two females he had not met before.
"Where to?" was his first question to me.
"Let me use your astropath and set course for the place we first met." I sent word in Glossier to Fischig, telling him to alter his route to avoid Gudrun and meet me at a new rendezvous point. "Thorn wishes Hound at Hound's Cradle by Sext." Maxilla's cadaverous, nameless navigator performed his hypermathematical feats of divination and set the SN thundering into warp space as fast as its potent drive could carry it. As always, I was unable to rest easily while travelling in the hellish netherworld of the warp, so instead I retired with Maxilla to his stateroom. He was a terrible gossip, and always relished a few hours catching up whenever we were reunited. Surrounded as he was by a crew that was more servitor than human, he did so crave company. But I had been looking forward to a private talk. I'd never confided in him particularly before, but now I felt he might be the only man in the Imperium who would give me a fair hearing. And, if not fair, then at least one free of harsh judgment. Maxilla was a rogue. He made no excuses about it. His entire life had been devoted to testing the ductile qualities of rules and regulations. I wanted, I suppose, to find out what he thought of me. His stateroom was a double-story cabin behind the SN's cathedral-like main bridge. A 10-seat banquet table of polished duralloy that I'd dined at many times before occupied a mezzanine area at the far end under a domed section of roof that could peel back shielding at the wave of a control wand to become an observation blister. Curved stairways with tephra wood balustrades that Maxilla claimed to have been salvaged from a 20-mast sunjammer on Nautilia ran down from either end of the mezzanine onto the main deck area, a wide hall with a floor of inlaid marble. Works of art, paintings, statues, antiques, hololiths, were displayed all round the room between the crystallophantine wall pillars. Some were protected by softly glowing stasis fields, others hung weightlessly in invisible repulsor beams. Elegant scroll-armed couches and chairs, some draped with throws of Sampanese light cloth, were arranged on a large rectangle of exquisite olitari rugwork in the centre of the room. The rug alone was worth a small fortune. The room was illuminated by six shimmering chandeliers from the glassworks of Vitria, each one suspended by a small antigrav plate so they floated below the dished ceiling. I sat down on a couch and accepted the balloon of Amasek Maxilla handed to me.
"You look like a man who wishes to unburden himself, Gregor," he said, taking a seat opposite.
"Am I so transparent?"
"No. I fear it is rather more a case that I am hopeful. It's been a boring few months. I crave excitement. And when the only man I know who makes a habit of getting involved in the most ridiculously perilous adventures anyone ever heard of calls to me for help, I perk up."
He fitted a low stick into a long silver holder, lit it with a tiny flick of his digital ring weapon, and sat back, exhaling spiced smoke, rolling the Amasek in his glass around with an experienced hand.
I tried to begin, but I didn't really know where to start.
He put his glass down and made a gesture with his control wand like a theatrical conjurer. The air became close and slightly muffled.
"Speak freely," he told me. "I've activated the suite's privacy field."
"Actually," I admitted, "my hesitation was more to do with not knowing what to say."
"I deal in routes and journeys, Gregor. In my experience, the best place to start is always..."
"The beginning, I know."
I told him, first in general terms, and then with increasing detail, about the events as they had unfolded. Jura, Thuring, the battles with Krua Vult and Cherubale. His dyed face became tragic, like a clown's, as I told him about Elizabeth. He had always had a soft spot for her. Though I felt I had taken his advice and started from the beginning, I realized more and more that I had not. I kept going back, filling in details. To explain Cherubale, I had to go back to Farnus Beta and the struggle against Quixos, and that in turn required mention of the mission to Kincher. I told him about the assault on Spaten House and our desperate flight across Gudrun. I recounted the murders that had taken place across the subsector. He'd known Harlan Nail and Nathan Inchibel, not to mention several other members of my team. My account of Pontius Glaw's revenge was a litany of bad tidings. Once I had begun, I couldn't stop. I spared nothing. It felt liberating to confess everything at last and unburden myself. I told him about the Malus Codicium and how I might have compromised myself by keeping it. I told him about my dabbling with demon hosts and thralls and warp vortices. I owned up to the deal I had struck with Glaw on Kincher and how that had empowered him and turned him into the threat that now pursued me. Everyone, Tobias, everyone in my operation, my family, if you will, everyone except you, Fischig, and the handful I brought aboard here with me, has died because of what I did on Kincher. Something in the order of, well, I haven't made an exact count, 200 servants of the Imperium. 200 people who had devoted themselves to my cause in the firm belief that I was doing good work are dead. I'm not even counting the likes of Paul Rassi, Duclane Haar, and that poor bastard Vervuk who perished in what turns out to be the overture to this bloodbath. Or Magos Bure, who must have been killed by Glaw for him to have escaped.
Might I correct you, Gregor? He asked.
By all means.
You called it your cause. That they were devoted to your cause. But it isn't, is it?
What do you mean?
You still passionately believe that you are doing the Emperor's work.
Damn right I do.
Then they died in the service of the Emperor. They died for his cause. No Imperial citizen can ask for anything more.
I don't think you were listening, Maxilla. He got to his feet.
No, I don't think you were, Inquisitor. Not even to yourself. I'm pressing this point because it's so basic you seem to have overlooked it.
He walked across the stateroom and stood looking up at a hololithic portrait of an Imperial warrior. It was very old. I didn't want to think where he might have got it from.
Do you know who this is?
No.
Warmaster Terfuik. Commanded the Imperial forces in the Pacificus War almost 50 centuries ago. Ancient history now. Most of us couldn't say what the damn war was about anymore. At the Battle of Kurosa, Terfuik committed 4 million Imperial guardsmen to the field. 4 million, Gregor. They don't do battles like that anymore, thank the throne. It was, of course, the age of high imperialism, the era of the notable warmaster, the cult of personality. Anyway, Terfuik got his victory. Not even his advisers thought he could win at Kurosa, but he did. And of those 4 million men, only 90,000 left the field alive.
Maxilla turned and looked at me.
Do you know what he said, Terfuik? Do you know what he said of that terrible cost?
I shook my head.
He said it was the greatest honour of his life to have served the Emperor so well.
I'm happy for him.
You don't understand, Gregor. Terfuik was no butcher, no glory hound. By all accounts, he was humane and beloved by his men as fair and generous. But when the time came, he did not regret for a moment the cost of serving the Emperor and preserving the Imperium against all odds.
Maxilla sat down again.
I think that's all you're guilty of. Making hard choices to serve the Emperor the best you can, to serve him where maybe others would not be strong enough and fail. Doing your duty and living with the consequences. I'm sure dear Terfuik had sleepless nights for years after Kurosa, but he dealt with that pain. He didn't have any regrets.
Committing men to battle is not quite the same as...
I beg to differ. Imperial society is your battleground. The people you have lost were your soldiers, and soldiers are only martial resources. They are there to be used. You used your own resources to win your battles. This book you speak of, this demon host, he sounds fascinating. I'd love to meet him.
You wouldn't, I assure you. And it's an it, not a he. Maxilla shrugged.
I fancy you wanted to talk to me about this because you thought you might get a sympathetic ear. Me being an old rogue and everything.
There were times, I swear, I believed Maxilla could read my mind.
Let me tell you something, Gregor. I love you like a brother, but we're nothing alike. I am a rogue, a gambler, a liar, a reprobate. My vices are many,
and unmentionable. I never bend the rules. I break them, snap them, shatter them, however and wherever I may. In that regard alone, I am a kindred spirit. You are bending the rules of the Imperium, of the Inquisition. You are undoubtedly what they call a radical. But that's where the similarity ends. I break the rules for my own gain, to get what I want, to amplify my wealth and status, to make things better for me. Me. Just me. But you're not doing it for yourself. You're doing it for the system you believe in and the God Emperor you worship, and by damn, that means your conscience can be clean. I was taken aback by the passion of his speech. I was also taken aback by the suggestion, one that no one had dared make before, that I had become a radical. When had that happened? My actions may have been radical, but did that make me a radical to the marrow? Sitting there, in that opulent room, I realized Maxilla had hit on the truth, a truth I had been denying. I had changed, without recognizing that change in myself. I would always be grateful to Tobias Maxilla for that bruising realization. I felt better for it.
I suppose you can't turn to your superiors for help.
No, I said, still reeling from the fresh viewpoint.
Because you'd have to tell them things you don't want them to hear.
Of course. To get any kind of official help, I'd have to make a full report. And that report would fall apart under the lightest scrutiny if it omitted the Codicium, Cherubale. By the throne, the list goes back. I even hid Pontius Glore from them. What could I say? Pontius Glore is exterminating my forces. Where did he come from, my Lord Grandmaster? Well, to be honest, I've known of his existence for centuries, but I kept him hidden from you. And he's only up and around now because I decided to give him a body. He chuckled.
I see your point. What will you tell Fischig? Dear Godwin is as straight up and down as any man I know.
I'll deal with Fischig.
So, what is your next move? You mentioned this daughter of his, the Psyker. You saw things when you killed her, didn't you?
I had indeed. Marla Tare's entire mental shield had crumbled just before the vortex annihilated her. The picture I had obtained was far from complete, but it was plentiful. Marla Tare was much older than she looked or claimed. She was the bastard offspring of Pontius Glore and a serving girl from Gudrun that Glore had taken with him to Quenthus VIII. Marla was born in 020, corrupted from conception by the tainted talk Pontius wore. Several notorious heretics who have evaded the Inquisition in the last 300 years were actually her under different guises. Many cases could be closed now she is dead.
Pontius won't be too pleased.
I imagine Pontius Glore now wants me dead even more than before. But they were after the Malus Codicium, you see. I learned that from her undefended mind. Glore knew Quixos must have it, and, once Quixos was dead, realized it must be in my possession. He wants that book so much.
Do you know why?
I saw images of an arid world just before Marla Tare died, a dried-out husk where primeval cities lay buried under layers of ash. Glore's after something there, and he needs the Codicium to help him.
What?
I don't know.
Where?
I don't know that either. There was a name, a word in her mind. Ghoul. But I don't know what it means or what it refers to. Her mind was in collapse. Very little made sense.
I'll consult my charts and my navigator. Who knows?
He sat forward and looked at me.
This book, this Malus Codicium. May I see it?
Why?
Because I appreciate unique and priceless objects.
I took it from my jacket and passed it to him. He studied it with reverence, a smile on his face.
Not much to look at, but beautiful for what it is. Thank you for the opportunity to hold it.
He handed it back to me.
I can't believe I'm going to say this,
he added.
Me, of all people. But I'd destroy it if I were you.
I think you're right. I believe I will. I put down my empty glass and walked to the doors. Maxilla evaporated the privacy field. Thank you for your time and hospitality, Tobias. I think I'll turn in now.
Sleep well.
One last thing, I said, turning back in the doorway. You said you break the rules to get what you want, that you serve no one but yourself, and everything you do is for your own ends.
I did.
Then why do you help me so often? He smiled.
Good night, Gregor.
The SN put in at Hubris 4 days later. Hubris was an outlying world in the Helican subsector, and Fischig, Beckwin, Maxilla and I had all met there for the first time in 240. Indirectly, that's where we'd first stumbled across Pontius Glore, too. Everything was turning full circle in the strangest way. I had rerouted Fischig here as a convenient and out-of-the-way meeting place, but it seemed apt. He'd been a chastener in the local Arbites when he'd first crossed my path. It was his homeworld. For 11 out of every 29 months, Hubris orbits so far beyond its star that the population are forced to hibernate in massive cryogenic tombs to survive the blackness and the cold. Those winters of eternal night are called dormant, and I had experienced one on that last visit. But now we arrived at the start of thaw, the middle season between dormant and vital. The tombs had emptied, and the great cities were waking under a pale sun. The population was engaged in a frenzied jubilee of feasting and dancing and general excess that lasted 3 weeks and was supposed to celebrate the society's rebirth, but which probably had deep-rooted origins in the traditional methods of recovery from extended cryogenic suspension, such as forced physical activity and high calorie intake. I offered to travel to the surface to meet him, partly because I thought Kresia, Alina, and Medea could do with the relaxation of a festival, and Maxilla had never been one to turn down a party. But Fischig answered he would as soon come up to the SN, and he arrived, piloting his own shuttle, a few hours later. I could tell he was tense from the moment he stepped aboard. He was polite and seemed pleased to see Medea, Amos, and Maxilla. But with me, he was reserved. I told him it was good to see him, and that I was relieved he had escaped Glor's purge.
"Glore, eh?" he said.
He had heard all about the fall of the distaff and our other holdings.
"I had wondered who it was."
"We need to talk," I said.
"Yes," he said, "but not here."
Maxilla lent us his stateroom, and I turned on the privacy field. "There's nothing you couldn't say in front of the others, Godwin," I said.
"No. Glor's killed everyone except us few. Because..."
"Because?"
"You should have destroyed that monster years ago, Eisenhorn. That, or handed him over to the Ordos. What the hell were you thinking?"
"Same as I'm thinking now. I did what was best."
"Nail, Inchabel, Bure, Suskova, the whole damn distaff. That was best."
His tone was venomous. "Yes, Fischig. And I never heard you contradict my decisions."
"Like you'd have listened."
"To you, yes. Not once did I hear you say we should turn Glore over to the Ordos."
"Because you always make it sound so logical, like you know best."
I shrugged. "This is beneath you, Godwin. It sounds like sour grapes. Things didn't turn out the way I would have wished, and you're making out it's all my fault. I took tough decisions that I thought were right. If you'd ever, ever objected, I'd have considered your opinion."
"Too easy. Too damn easy. I was only ever your lackey, your minion. If I'd said we vaporize Glore, you'd have said yes and then hidden him anyway. Do you really think I'm that underhand? You, of all my council, I respect the most." "Yeah?"
He tossed his gloves onto a couch and helped himself to a schooner of Maxilla's claw blood.
"Who told Bure to build Glore a body without telling any of us? Who suddenly knows how to conjure demons like an expert? You cover your secrets with such an almighty righteous air. We all thank the stars and the Emperor himself you chose us to help you in your work. But you're a liar, a conspirator, and maybe worse."
"And you're too much a Puritan idealist for your own good. And mine," I hissed. "I dearly wanted your help, Godwin. You are one of the few men I really trust and one of the few humans in space with a stalwart spirit to keep me on the level. I needed you now in my fight to destroy Glore. I can't believe you're turning against me like this." He stared down at the contents of his glass.
"I always did warn you I would if you crossed the line."
"I've crossed no line. But if you feel that way, go. Get off this ship and leave me to my work. You'll always have my gratitude for the service you put in, but I won't have this bitterness."
"That's what you think?"
"Yes." He hesitated.
"I gave my life to you, Gregor. I admired you. I always believed you were right.
I still am. I serve the Emperor, just like you. Get rid of your rancor and we can work together again. Let me think about it. 2 days, and we're leaving orbit.
2 days, then.
Apparently, his ruminations only took him a day. I had just received, via the SN's Astropath Bank, a rather fascinating communique, and I went looking for Fischig. I found Crezier playing regicide with Maxilla in a mid-deck suite. He'd taken quite a shine to Dr. Bershildi. She got up as I entered the room and excitedly displayed the stunning fun silk gown she was wearing.
"Tobias had his servitors make it for me. Isn't it gorgeous?"
"It is," I agreed.
"The poor woman has virtually no wardrobe at all, Gregor. Just a few travel bags. It was the least I could do.
You wait until you see the Epinchier dress they're embroidering for her."
"Have you seen Fischig?" I asked. Crezier looked at Maxilla sharply, and the shipmaster suddenly became occupied with his study of the game board. "What?" I asked. Crezier took me by the arm and walked me over to the cabin windows.
"He's gone, Gregor."
"Gone?"
"Early this morning. He left in his shuttle. Dreadful man."
"He was my friend, Crezier."
"Not anymore, I think."
"Did he say anything?"
"No, not to me. Or to Tobias, except a quick goodbye. He was up late last night, though, talking to Medea and Amos."
"About what?"
"I don't know. I wasn't included.
Tobias took Alina and me on a guided tour of his art collection."
"He has some extraordinary pe—"
"They talked, and this morning he just left."
"I like Medea, but I think she may be a little careless."
"I'd never have told that Fischig man about the things you did in New Givet." "And she did."
"I'm just saying, she might have."
I had servitors summon Amos and Medea. They arrived in my stateroom at about the same moment. Both of them looked awkward. "Well?"
"Well, what?"
snapped Medea. "What the hell did you say to him?" She looked away. Amos toyed with the hem of his cloak.
"I simply tried to make him understand, Gregor, about what you were doing, what you had done. I thought if he knew it all, he might see it like I see it."
"Really? It didn't cross your mind he was a puritanical son of a bitch on a hair trigger, just like he's always been?"
"I felt honesty was the best policy," Amos muttered.
Medea said something under her breath. "Oh, say it so we can all hear," I snarled.
"Honesty is the best policy," Medea said. "I was appreciating the irony."
"How so?"
"The stuff you never told us. The honesty you withheld."
"That's rich coming from you, Medea Betancourt. In point of fact, I believe I told you everything. Shared everything. Sworn on my secrets."
"Yeah, well."
She looked away. "Oh, throne. You told him, didn't you? You told him about Cherubael and the Caduceum and Glore and everything." She turned on me, tears in her anguished eyes.
"I thought he would understand if everything was out in the open."
"No wonder he left," I said, sitting down.
"Medea was only doing the same as me," Amos said. "We were defending you to him, trying to make him understand and see things the way we saw them. We thought—"
"What?"
"We thought he might change his mind and trust you again if he knew it all."
"I thought you both had more sense," I said, as I strode past them and out of the room. There were several craft cradled in the SN's hangar. 2 ferry pods, a bulk pinnace, 3 standard shuttles, and a number of small flyers. I was busy directing the deck servitors to make a 2-man speeder flight ready when Medea came in, red-eyed and dressed for the surface in a fleece jacket.
"I'll fly you down," she said.
"Don't bother. You've done enough."
"It's my job, Gregor. I'm your pilot."
"Forget about it." I clambered into the tight cockpit of the bright red speeder, pulled the canopy shut, and fired up the single inline thruster. The launch chute opened, and I shot away from the SN at full throttle. I tracked his flight path to Catharsis, the capital city of Hubris. Festival flares and fireworks were spitting up above the slanted roofs of the vast inland metropolis. The Jubilee was in full swing. Once I had parked the sprightly little flyer at Catharsis Downport, I found myself weaving through a dense river of jumping, whooping people that clogged the winding streets. All of them showed the grey pallor of recent cold sleep. All of them were drunk. Bottles were pressed into my hands, and young women and men alike planted kisses on my face. I was jostled and shoved and scattered with petals and confetti. The smell of the cryogenic chemicals sweating out of them permeated the entire town. It took all afternoon to find him. He was alone in an upstairs suite in a crumbling but characterful hotel overlooking the processional tombs. "Get out," he said as I opened the door. "Godwin, get the hell out," he yelled, smashing a shot glass against the far wall. He'd been drinking hard, which was unlike him, although everyone else on Hubris except me must have been in the same state. Fireworks coughed and whizzed in the square under his windows. Fishy glowered at me for a long time and then disappeared into the suite's bathroom. He emerged with two more shot glasses and a dish of ice. I stood in the doorway and watched as he slowly and carefully prepared two drinks. Anise poured over smashed ice. He placed one in front of himself and slid the other one towards the chair opposite. To me, that was an act of diplomacy. I sat down facing him and lifted the glass. "To all we've been together," I said. We knocked back the shots. I slid the glass back across the tabletop towards him, and he made two more. He passed the second one back to me and caught my eyes for the first time. I stared into his face, saw the eye-fogging scar that had already marked him by the time we met, saw the faint mauve scar tissue where the side of his face had been rebuilt after our clash with a Ceruthi on the warped world orbiting KCX-1288.
"I never meant to run out on you," he said.
"I didn't ever suppose so. When did Godwin Fischig last run out on a fight?" He laughed bitterly. We sank the second drink, and he fixed a third. "Whatever Medea told you, whatever Amos told you, it's true, but it's not what you think."
"Yeah?"
"I'm no heretic, Godwin."
"No?"
"I think I might have become what you'd call a radical, but I'm no heretic."
"Isn't that what a heretic would say?"
"Yes, I guess so.
If you'd let me into your mind, you'd see." "No thanks,"
he shuddered, shoving his chair back with a squeak. "Okay," I sipped my glass. "It won't be the same without you."
"I know. You and me. Bastards. The Eye of Terror itself was shy of us."
"Yes, it was."
"We could do it again,"
he said. "We could?"
"We could work side by side like old times and hunt out the darkness."
"Yes, we could. I'd like that."
"That's why I'm sorry I ran out like that. I should have stayed."
I nodded. "Yes."
"I owe you that much. I should have tried harder. You're not gone. Not all the way. You're just slipping."
"Slipping?"
"Into the pit. The radical pit. The pit no one comes back from. But I can pull you out."
"Pull me out?"
"Yes. It's not too late."
"Too late for what, Godwin?"
"Salvation," he said.
The crowds outside were screaming and clapping. Barrages of fireworks were being launched into the early evening air, scattering new stars in their wake like fireflies. "What does salvation mean?" I asked.
"It's why I'm here. Why the Emperor put me at your side. To keep you centered. It's destiny."
"Is it? And what does destiny entail?"
"Renounce it all. All of it. Give over the Malus Caedicium to me. The demon host. Your rune staff. Let me take you back to the Ordo's headquarters on Thracian. You can do penance there. I'll plead for you. Plead for leniency. They wouldn't be too hard on you. You'd be active again before too long."
"You actually believe that you could take me back to the Ordos, tell them what I've done, and they'd let me practice again?"
"They'd understand."
"Fischig, you don't understand." He looked at me, disappointed.
"You won't then?"
"I think this is where I say goodbye. I admire your efforts, but I can't be saved, Godwin."
"You can."
"No," I shook my head. "You know why? I don't need saving."
"Then this is where I say goodbye too,"
he said, pouring another drink. "Remember what we did," I said.
"Yes."
I shut the door behind me and left. It took me 3 hours to get back to the landing field through the solid mob of revelers. I powered the quick-heeled red speeder back up to the SN. They were all waiting for me in the hangar as I docked. Maxilla, Crezia, Elena, Amos, Medea. I tugged the rumpled copy of the astropathic communique I had received earlier out of my pocket and tossed it at Maxilla. We're breaking orbit. New destination. Promedy.
What about Fischig?
Asked Elena. He isn't coming. There is a move in Carthayan blade work called the Tet Uin Sar. The phrase literally describes a position of the feet, but the philosophy is deeper. It means the moment in a duel when you gain the advantage and begin to win home. It is the turning point, the little fulcrum on which a life-or-death fight turns. The moment your fortunes change and you realize victory can be yours if you rally hard enough. I felt that the astropathic communique from Promedy was the equivalent of the Tet Uin Sar. It had been sent to me, uncoded, by a trusted friend I hadn't seen in a long time. It read simply, Kanyar must be stopped. It took the SN 10 weeks to reach Promedy, a jungle world on the trailing hem of the Scarus sector, specifically the Antimar subsector. I went planetside alone, using the little red speeder, in case it turned out to be a trap. They were waiting for me on a tropical hillside, below a brake of pink-lobed punz trees. The evening was warm and fragrant. Insects fidgeted in the gathering dark. The air was humid. I got out of the steaming speeder. My old pupil, Gideon Ravenor, sustained by his force chair, rolled forward across the mossy ground to greet me. To his left, he was flanked by Kara Swole. To his right, Harlan Nail.